that he will be coming to do a special summer colloquium for this class. Autumn saw him speak, Elvin Ikoku, he's a MD, Nigerian, I believe, who's a PhD candidate at Columbia in humanities and narrative. He was scheduled to come speak in conjunction with Lance's spring class on narrative ethics, but it was that one massive snowstorm where the city sort of shut down for a couple days, and we just couldn't reschedule. And I knew he had sort of international focus coupled with the narrative, so it actually worked out really, I think, quite well that we're able to bring in somebody who is an MD and a humanities type scholar who can bring a narrative perspective to international questions of health and healthcare and health access and equity and all these sorts of things. So he's chosen a story, Richard Seltzer's, what is it, Imelda, which I haven't read. It's a 12-page short story. He tried to send me the PDF, but it just never came through, so I'm tracking down the book to just make my own copy. And I'll email the PDF to you, and I'll have it available for all the MBE students. We'll be meeting in the big room. So instead of having class that day, that will be our class. And you're more than welcome to use that as a topic for your final presentation as well. If there's something about narrative ethics, about narrative that really grabs you, you could do, you know, do a paper about other narrative stories. You know, there's got to be, well, I'm saying there's got to be, there's most likely are many patient stories or practitioner stories or, you know, relief care worker stories that you could talk about. I just thought it would be a nice third dimension because we've read sort of clinical case studies from medical journals. We've read a lot of social science and anthropological type literature, and this will be another data source for understanding global bioethics and global health. So he's confirmed for the third. Yeah, looking ahead. You know, today we're finishing. Hopefully, everyone got my email and could sort of bring their minds back a little bit to last week, because I didn't want to ignore that article, "The Cycling Overseas," and I understand that a lot of people in here took reproductive ethics last semester, and that there was a chunk of time spent on international surrogacy. So that'll be good to bring to the conversation. And then we're really going to focus on just one aspect of the pharmaceuticals. We're going to focus on clinical research, international clinical research. Next week, we will sort of get more into the Whitmarsh article, which talks about sort of pharmaceuticals, you know, more in situ of a culture, and the vaccines. And then I think we can do both of those next week quite nicely. Okay. Tape recorder's on. All right. To get us started in this conversation again, let's just start with, you know, new reproductive technologies. What are we talking about when we talk about new reproductive technologies? Just very simply, you know.
IVF.
There's IVF, sure. There's surrogacy. Mm-hmm.
Along with IVF, PGD, which is pre-implantation genetic testing or
diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And for people who don't know, can you explain what that is?
It's the fact that you can do gene sequencing of an embryo, usually part of IVF. So, you know, they do that as part of picking the best embryo, but also with the advent of all sorts of genetic testing, it's the potential to kind of engineer your child.
What do you mean by best embryo?
That's the gray area. A lot of the time it's, you know, which is most likely to, like, actually produce offspring, you know, which is
right, the most viable.
But then mm-hmm. it opens the door with the, you know, like, do I want a girl or a boy? Do I want a deaf child? Do I not mm-hmm. want a deaf child? And starting to speak for those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, because as is traditionally talked about, best means viable.
Yeah.
And it's now people are talking about other ways. Right, so let's take those as the big three. IVF, surrogacy, and PGD, D, or whatever the abbreviation is. Ethically, when people talk about the ethics of new reproductive technologies, in the U.S., not in a global context, what are some of the issues that you talked about in reproductive ethics that you hear about in the news? What are the sort of the common go-to ethics of reproductive technologies? Yeah.
Sort of beating the biological clock, enabling women in particular to conceive beyond what they might naturally, like the age that they might naturally conceive.
Mm-hmm. And sort of when ethicists talk about that, what is their concern? What's the concern with a, what was it? Oldest, Art Kaplan wrote a column on it. How old was she? Had a baby?
I have no idea.
63, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I know in particular, this might be too specific, that for both men and women, as they get older, the risk for autism goes up when they have children. I know that's probably too specific, but
no,
maybe
we're
just generally like any kind of problem like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the access to IVF from a cost standpoint, like fair. But, you know, right now, it's pretty expensive, so a lot of...
Right, and when you couple access with PGD, you get talk of developing a, you know, you talk of eugenics again. Yeah, Jasmine?
Just the idea of being able to engineer your baby, you know, playing God. I want a child with the blue eyes, blonde hair, you know, boy, girl. Mm-hmm. I hear that a lot.
Is there a distinction between physical traits and disease susceptibility?
I mean, something that comes in with respect to like what's acceptable to select for. Is it okay to select for disease, or is it where do you draw the line?
There's some people that are arguing that it would be beneficial to select against Huntington's,
Does anybody know, last time I looked it up, it was a couple years ago, current state of U.S. regulations about PGD and disease susceptibility? Like, what are you allowed to select for if you're an IVF clinic?
I want to say the U.S. is one of the places that doesn't have any regulations on what you can select for. I think internationally, gender is one of the few things that comes up. Some places say that you can't, and some places say that you can. But I don't think they really have a standard decision about what you can and can't do right now.
I don't think so either. And I know Great Britain, a few years ago, added BRCA 1 and 2 to their list of things that you could select for. And people were really freaked out by that. That's the breast cancer susceptibility gene. Because our understanding of what those genetic markers mean is changing all the time. I mean, when they were first discovered, it was like, we found it, you know, the gene for breast cancer. And we've learned over the years that it's much more complicated than that. So if you're allowing, by law, something that has a little bit more of slippery edges, then the question becomes, well then, you know, what else could be considered a liability or a disability? There's a huge movement, and Carol Schilling talked about it in her lunchtime talk a couple weeks ago with members of the deaf and hard of hearing community wanting to select for deaf children.
We read an article about a couple in the UK, a deaf couple that
were being taken to court. I feel like we heard both sides, like somewhere it's like you know, is it doing damage to actually select a child with disability versus to choose, actively, like so on that end, like, are you doing damage to the child even now? Like, that's a weird kind of...
Well, people have filed wrongful birth suits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end, like, what does it mean if, like, to the larger disability community, if you're choosing to actively select against a certain trait like that?
Let's go Matt, and then Jamie, and then Shauna.
That just reminded me, like, I read an article recently about, I guess it was a couple who were both blind, who, I guess they were doing some sort of, baby selection technology, but they were ensuring them, so that they were ensuring that they would have a child that could see, only so it could take care of them. mind you. But I mean, that was, I mean, it's sort of different, but it's sort of along the same lines. Like, you know, it's the reverse. Opposed to choosing for being deaf, it's like they're choosing for sight.
Mm-hmm. I'd look it up. Jamie?
There's also a similar push for families of little people that are afflicted with dwarfism that have a similar desire to have genetically similar children.
Mm-hmm. And Shauna, what?
Yeah, I was just going to say generally, it sort of goes right into disability studies and ethics and, you know, what is a disability in terms of definition and in terms of, you know, what that community, if you want to call it community, thinks. Because I know a lot of deaf people don't consider themselves disabled at all.
Right.
So then selecting for a deaf baby is not actually hurting the child to them. So there's so many different perspectives on that.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. I guess to your point about dwarfism, I think that's really complicated by the fact that a lot of times if you're homozygous for a certain gene, then you will die before you proceed past infancy. But if you're heterozygous, then you're just a normal dwarf, so to speak. I don't actually know what the correct, term is. But then it just kind of complicates this pre-implantation genetic diagnosis because,
So they both come with the phenotype, but only one leads to pathology from it? Both of them lead to short stature, but only one, the homozygous, leads to, you know, pathologies and as a result of that?
I think both lead to pathologies eventually, but I mean, I think dwarfism, you have a lot of complications in adulthood, but if you're homozygous, you don't live to be an adult. So, I mean, I feel really uncomfortable because I know that there's a better term than dwarf, but the dwarfs that we see are all heterozygous. So I know that pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is used a lot in
just
normal pregnancies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sorry, not
pre-implantation,
but just
amniocentesis.
Okay.
Andy? I'm trying to understand why this makes us uncomfortable. It's playing God. We're playing God when we give people chemotherapy, or when we take off limbs or give people prostheses. So they can walk. I find that it makes me uncomfortable to think you can pick out all sorts of characteristics, but I'm not sure how that's any more playing God than treating dread diseases or the common cold.
I think because let's say with autism, if you're specifically discarding embryos that have autism, what does it say about the people with autism that are already here that you've discarded those embryos? So you're making a judgment call about what a life worth living. And then I think another thing that we brought up is all research that's being done to solve this. I mean, if you're taking that community, it's almost like you're weeding them out.
But by
the families that are here with that funding don't have that, you know, I don't know.
By choosing anything, you are by definition weeding out others.
Something else,
yes.
Right.
But then it's any personal choice. Like, I mean, if you're talking about prosthetic limbs or treating people who are currently alive with the condition, they are in part an agent in that choice, or hopefully, or, well, I guess not always, but.
Not always for children, embryonic surgery.
Right. Children, and parents decide so many things for their children, how they want to raise them and what they want them to, be involved in, all that kind of stuff.
Sure, but I think that's different than discarding embryos. I mean, are we saying that there's no difference there?
I'm trying to understand.
I kind of agree.
Why playing God is unethical in certain circumstances, but not others.
Well, I think it's unethical when you have families who have access to this kind of stuff because of the money, and then they genetically engineer their perfect child who's smarter, who runs faster, who.
It's
GAPCA.
But only in the U.S. do we have access to certain medications. As a result of wealth.
And only certain people in the U.S. have access to prostheses, prosthetic limbs.
Correct.
And cancer treatments.
Correct.
And better, if you take it even one step further, only certain people have access to private schools and stuff like that that make their children smarter and run faster and stuff like
Get
that.
Get them into the right fraternities of people. I think your question is a good one, and it's going to come up, and it comes up in the whoever the author was, Whitmarsh, the Cycling Overseas article, is that there something, because the one key difference is one deals with the process of reproduction and literally of the creation of a life, you know, as opposed to fixing a life that's already here. Because when I talk and I think about, you know, genetically engineering new babies, my sort of gut reaction, unencumbered by theory, is just, what about the natural wonder of life? Which, you know, sounds hokey to talk about it, you know, because it's so not theoretical. I mean, you could probably craft a very nice theoretical argument around it. But there's that gut of, there's something different about this. And that's, I think, what is important to be teased out, what it is. Some people may say it's, you know, the agency of the person doing. You know, yes, we all talk about agency over our children, even if it's embryonic, you know, or prenatal surgery. But when you're talking, and I don't have a problem with discarding embryos, so that's not my issue. You know, not that I'm willy-nilly discarding embryos right and left, but that is not an issue for me that is personally of concern. So is there something, does it then reach farther to sort of not just the nature of the actions that we do, are we physicians, are we this, are we that, or the other thing, but sort of does it get us to the nature of what it means to be human, the nature of the ability to reproduce? We'll talk in a couple minutes about, in the global context, about the commodification of a human body. Perhaps there's something there, that it's getting us too close, it's moving humanness into a market realm. Because we're talking about who has access, who can afford it, what does it mean? That's where I think I don't have a complete well-formulated answer, but I think it has something to do with the commodification and the sort of medicalization of the process.
You could go back as far as just testing the genetic testing for Tay-Sachs, and you'll just say to a couple, you should not have children because you're both positive, or then that's about as benign as you're going to get in terms of genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't offend anybody, I think.
Right.
Tell people that they can't have children?
No, that they shouldn't. That if you decide to have children, you have a one chance in four or whatever of having a child with Tay-Sachs. Therefore, I will decide to adopt. Or one chance in two. I don't know what the genetic probabilities are, but that's a form of genetic engineering.
Okay.
And interfering with the natural magical process of reproduction. But I don't think anybody's offended by it, and I just think it's a matter of each step you take.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of intervention, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Well, this kind of plays into that then too, because I think it's also a question of enhancement versus treatment, and I think that the playing God gets complicated when it's something where it's like enhancing what you would describe as enhancing a potential offspring versus like treating something that could be, you know, problematic, and that's how it also kind of gets layered in with the idea of, okay, well, fixing someone who's already here, or, you know, enhancing something that's going to be, and that's the concept of enhancement versus treatment, and how that makes us a little uncomfortable, I think.
That's true. Good point.
I also think beyond the level of individual selection for traits, on a community level, there's already proof that we can't do this responsibly yet. In India, there are states that have mounting disparities between the number of male children and female children, and it's creating social and reproductive chaos or whatever, or discord anyhow. So we might need at least some regulations before we get step forward.
All good points. And we're just going to complicate them even more by putting them in a global context. We talked about access. Nobody mentioned the Octomom. You know, sort of. I hate my children, they disgust me. too many gossip blogs.
Did she say that?
But then she said she didn't actually say that. But yeah, she said she spends hours in the bathroom crying. Which I would too. And I think every parent could probably say at one point or another that their children are driving them absolutely insane and are disgusting little creatures. But we just don't say that. To a reporter.
So,
just spent a weekend with some friends. Trying to travel with a two-year-old is hard. You don't get any sleep. And they're annoying. And they scream. Gender trait selection we talked about. There's also the question of sort of paternity-maternity. If you're talking about surrogacy with a donated egg and dad's sperm, you got potentially three moms, one dad. So there's a whole, there's sort of the ethical and legal issues of who has rights. It's one of the people we talked about a couple weeks ago who said they went overseas because the Indian surrogate, or is this something just I want? Did we talk about this? That the Indian surrogate mother, it's written into sort of the law that they have no rights. Once that baby is born, it's a handover, bump, done, the end. Whereas in the United States, sort of the surrogates end up having, for, I don't know if it's for a particular period of time or what, but sort of a right of refusal to comply with the arrangement. Very similar sort of issues with adoption. We see this with sperm donation, people trying to track down their biological parents. So you also get, in terms of reproductive technologies, issues of identity. Who am I? What does my genetic background mean to me versus my family background versus the stories that my family has told myself? Sort of the power of genetic information. People mention Gattaca, and part of me thinks, oh, that's just, it's an extreme science fiction movie, but, if you want to have sort of cases where you're sort of saying, I need a guarantee, or sort of a money-back guarantee that my child will be born sighted or short or whichever case it was, you could see if someone's selecting for traits for speed, good tennis ability, and then that person doesn't like tennis, parental expectations of their children. How do you live up to that? If you've been genetically engineered to be perfect, and that was the Jude Law character in Gattaca. He was genetically engineered to be perfect, and he only ever got the silver medal. And it destroyed his life. So there is, obviously, reproductive ethics is bread and butter within bioethics proper. And this is just a very brief spewing of an overview. So what happens when we put it in a global context? Our article for last week talked about the problem of bio-crossings. So that, if you want to look at new reproductive technologies in just a U.S. context, they're still, I think she would argue, bio-crossings. They're breaches of human thresholds. If you want to say a natural human threshold is man and woman's sexual intercourse results in a baby, in any way, shape, or form that you're altering that basic formula, you're sort of breaching sort of the human thresholds. Perhaps ethical thresholds, sort of transhumanism, scientific thresholds. We didn't talk about this, but people have said, what about all the experimentation that has to happen before you get this right? But when you put it in a global context, you also then add transnational and cultural thresholds. And she refers to the marketing of bioavailability. What does she mean by that? What are we talking about? What do you think she means? The marketing of bioavailability. And why is it something that she deems worthy of being talked about?
Maybe like just this idea of, painting the picture that this is where we want to go. Just getting people used to the idea that like there will be a large market of kidneys available in the future. Or just like, I'm thinking of the term very literally, just like what resources are,
available and how new ones will emerge, what mm-hmm. that looks like.
Sure. I mean, if you're going to look at human bodies, whether as organ suppliers or as surrogates or as egg donors or whatever, as a natural resource, that's bioavailability. And anybody that studied sort of the history of sort of markets and natural resources, you know how that story plays out. Resource-rich countries exploit the natural resources of sort of capital-rich countries exploit the natural resources of capital-poor countries. Whether it be stripping rubber trees, agricultural products, and now what they're saying is sort of people, is that there is a large group of bodies that are available to enter into market transactions. That is less talked about in the United States. I mean, we talk a little bit about, you know, the ads on college campuses for, you know, young egg donors of a particular, with particular SAT scores and particular eye and hair color, as sort of a, you know, a hierarchy of bodies. But when you put it into a global context and you talk about global distributions of resources and power and money, I do like her that phrase, the marketing of bioavailability. And it gets to where she really wants to talk about this as a commodification of reproductive bodies. And that's, I think, where a lot of the this is different type responses come from. And it's sort of a highfalutin phrase, that reducing the nurturing affective labor of reproduction to exchange value. Anybody want to translate that into just sort of common everyday parlance?
It's not the natural, loving exchange that we have. There's none of that emotion. It becomes a trade of goods and services mm-hmm. without any humanity. Mm-hmm. Involved.
Exactly. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's taking away the wonder of life, the miracle of life, and replacing it with a straightforward commercial disaffective, unaffective, is that a term? Yeah.
Maybe now, maybe because it's new to mm-hmm. us, but to our grandparents, things we do are not the miracle of life. And they're strange to our grandparents. That's not the way they did it. But maybe our grandchildren will be commonplace and it will be a wonder and miracle, a certain way of handling things. So, when I take my two little kids to church on Sunday, I'm looked at, and I'm alone with two little kids in church, because I'm just, you know, a single dad with two little kids.
What do you mean you're looked at?
Because I'm a single dad with two little kids in church, and that's just not the norm.
Oh.
Where's your wife? Mm-hmm. So, by the old people. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, maybe this will be commonplace someday. I think it's just me.
Do you ever just want to freak him out and say,
yeah.
I'm gay and my partner died?
No.
I'm a gay widow.
No, people say, are they twins? And I say, no. And I go, but their moms look alike too. They are. But that's what they yeah, I think it's just, it'll be commonplace. I think it's just new. And it'll change as it gets more into the culture.
And for people who, the slippery slope type people, that's, I think, their fear. Is that once you take one little step and it becomes right. normalized, then you take the next little step and that becomes normalized.
Okay.
And then pretty soon you have a super race of, you know, tall Nordic fast runners. You know, good at math. I don't know.
But can you make the argument, I mean, that you're giving the miracle of life to somebody that couldn't have a baby on her own side? I mean, for whatever reason. So you're actually, it's still a commodity because she has to go somewhere, say, to India to get a surrogacy, mm-hmm. you know, get a surrogate for whatever reason. But otherwise she wouldn't even be able to experience that. I mean, I think that could be.
So is it a right? I'm not necessarily
saying
right.
It's a right, but I think it's, I don't think it's not devoid of emotional attachment, necessarily.
Okay, let's go with this for a while.
Hmm. I have trouble, because I think, okay, well, if it's not a right, then it's a privilege. But then, if it's a privilege, who is it a privilege to? Only those that can afford it? Is it? Do you then have to have it, does the country where you live have to cover it? How many, what if people don't have health insurance? And, here it's covered only a certain number of cycles, and there's all sorts of regulations, whereas other places it's covered and any number of cycles is covered. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I can't decide where I lie, because it's like, well, okay, I don't know. Is it a right? That kind of irks me.
Wendy.
It's just kind of rising, the way it relates to, of kidneys and stuff in India, too. And how, in one sense, there are a ton of people who need kidneys, and you're doing a service, you're able to donate your own. You're doing a lot of good, potentially, for the person who was on the receiving end of that. But at what cost to people who are giving you their kidney? And I feel like the same way for service, where do you weigh, the balance? You're doing such a service to people who maybe couldn't have children on their own, but then it will come to the women who are, are giving their bodies
And Chelsea and I were talking about this before class, and we were hoping that maybe other people who were in the reproductive ethics class might be able to provide some data. But it seems from just this one article and other things that I read in preparation for last week that, unlike kidney sale, where you sell a kidney and you're 99 times out of 100 worse off than you were before you sold it, the amount of money that's involved in surrogacy actually is turning people's lives around. That they're homeowners, their kids are in school, they've left bad situations, that life, it's, 8 or 9 years worth of salary in 9 months. Does anybody know any sort of data on that, or? Chelsea and Jane, you guys were?
I don't know any specific data, but I know we read a couple articles in that class about, examples of, I think it was actually women in India who were then able to put their kids through school and, that were like, oh yeah, I totally love being a surrogate, it's great, and, they're making enough money, and it's kind of, comparative, we're not, it's cheaper for, people from the U.S. to go to India to get their surrogate, because it's cheaper, but that amount of money for an Indian woman is enough to...
And you haven't taken anything from her, other than 9 months of her life, in the grand scheme of things. She can still have...
It's one of those, at least the way the article was written, she was really thrilled with the process, considering doing it either a second or a third time. Mm-hmm.